Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, an imagined Florida history at Disney Springs.
It is certainly a fabricated space, and it is a fabricated story, but it is a retelling of the past of Central Florida.
We'll discuss A Plague in Paradise.
The outbreak of St. Louis encephalitis in August 1962 in Pinellas County brought together forces of public health, emerging ecological science, and the economics of tourism.
And we'll talk with Miami poet Ariel Francisco. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Disney Springs celebrates an illusion of Florida history with a fictionalized narrative loosely based on fact. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Dr. Evan Noe is an assistant professor of history at the University of South Carolina, Lancaster. He is the historian for the university campus's Native American Studies Center. Dr. Noe also serves as an editor for the newly launched International Journal of Disney Studies. In 2015, the Walt Disney Company rebranded Downtown Disney, which served as Walt Disney World's shopping, entertainment, and dining complex, into Disney Springs. A closer connection to the Central Florida area partly fueled the transition as the company grew wary of tourists leaving the Disney property to explore other destinations in Central Florida. As a result, Disney Springs evokes a selective and quintessential representation of Florida, its history, and its heritage throughout the complex's four distinct neighborhoods: the Town Center, the Marketplace, the Landing, and the West Side. An artificial spring anchors the entire space, and Disney Springs' historically inspired narrative begins in 1850, when the fictional Sinclair family moved from South Carolina to Central Florida.
When you look at the Disney Springs narrative that the Disney Company conveys through this space, through the history of this sort of repurposed fictional town, begins in 1850. And you can see where this story is told through what is identified as sort of the original settler cabin of Disney Springs. And if you've been there, this is the restaurant known as Deluxe Burger. When you walk upon this, what is supposed to be a repurposed household, you get some really iconic elements of 19th century Florida architecture. When you walk up to Deluxe Burger, you get this impression that it was once a household, particularly a cracker cabin, sort of something built in Florida's vernacular style of the 19th century. It's got a high-pitched roof line, an extended porch, one that looks out on the waterway that's right alongside. And then when you go inside, you see a fireplace, not working necessarily, and then some other repurposed aesthetic elements that kind of convey this space as once a lived-in household turned into a restaurant. And then there are actually fabricated historical documents along the wall that tell this story a little bit specifically, particularly about how the family, the Sinclairs, moved to Central Florida from South Carolina in 1850 and established this homestead along this picturesque fabricated waterway that the cabin is sitting alongside.
The Town Center marks the next chronological point in Disney Springs' imagined Florida narrative, as the area's distinct Spanish Revival architecture reflects Addison Meisner's early 20th century architectural style. Despite architectural and Spanish colonial historians disproving that Spanish Revival architecture accurately portrays Spanish colonial buildings, Disney Springs, like Meisner in the 1920s, continues to use the style to sell Florida to tourists.
The Town Center is the next sort of distinctly chronologically oriented space. And this is where you get some of the most iconic Florida architectural styles built around Spanish Revival architecture. And this is really inspired by an architectural style that was put sort of on the map for being iconic of Florida by a guy named Addison Meisner. And Addison Meisner is going to be one of these Florida developers in the early 20th century, particularly in South Florida and Palm Beach specifically, who will really push this style through as iconic of the state of Florida. Architectural historians and historians of Spanish colonialism in North America have really pointed out that Florida's Spanish Revival architecture doesn't really have any sort of aesthetically similar elements to actual Spanish colonial styles. But one of the very consistent things that ends up happening in the way that this style is deployed in the early 20th century and then how it is reemployed by Disney Springs is that it always sort of had a tourist element to it. That they were trying to sell these spaces in the state of Florida to outsiders to come and see.
The marketplace and the landing follow the town center in Disney Springs' imagined Florida history. The former mirrors the 1920s and 1930s American craftsman style aesthetic, notably featured in the Kenwood Historic District outside of Tampa, and the latter widens the chronological scope by including industrial architectural styles from the 1890s to the 1960s.
We see chronologically the next sort of space is the marketplace. And the marketplace neighborhood is supposed to represent a 1920s, 1930s American craftsman style aesthetic. And it is certainly a style that is prevalent in Florida. There are areas of the state that are designated historic districts. There's one known as the Kenwood Historic District just outside of Tampa that has an abundance of American craftsman style homes. So then going to basically the lakeside of Disney Springs, you have the Landing. The Landing, as it's themed today, it's going to be a fairly widely chronological space in terms of what its aesthetic is. It's going to have features from basically the late 1890s through the 1960s. One of the iconic structures on the Landing is the Morimoto Asia restaurant, and it is the one that has the huge marquee that says Springs Bottling. And again, it sort of serves this dual purpose of not just a restaurant, but also a story-driven space. That is, when you walk in, it's supposed to be a refurbished bottling plant right alongside the spring water, where then this spring water is supposedly bottled and sold, presumably, you know, across the country. Certainly, Florida Springs and Florida Springs bottling companies are going to be something that are going to expand along with the state. We see first in Florida's tourist history, people coming to the state to take advantage of the fresh spring water, you know, assuming that it was going to have healing properties.
The Walt Disney Company designed the fourth and final neighborhood, the West Side, with bright pastel colors and flat building facades, evoking the Art Deco style most famously featured in Miami Beach. The West Side aesthetic also reflects a mid-century modern style, particularly from the well-known Sarasota School of Architecture.
So then on the West Side, you have what is literally called the West Side. And this very much uses sort of iconic Art Deco design features that are particularly found in South Beach and South Florida. So you get sort of the bright pastel colors, the wave designs, the starburst features on a lot of these building facades. A lot of the buildings had already sort of had flat rooftops that kind of fit well in, and they did different painting schematics to kind of reinforce that. But then we also see representations of mid-century modern sort of sub-style known as the Sarasota School that is very much specific to the state of Florida. And the best representation of this is actually the freestanding Starbucks coffee site in the West Side. This was a new facility built for the West Side. So when you approach this building, it embraces sort of that intentional locale of the Sarasota School that it invested in. So use of natural materials, simple shapes, rectangular features, large glass walls to sort of focus on exterior spaces.
Disney Springs' historically based fictional narrative emphasizes a settler colonial interpretation of Florida's past, obscuring the presence of non-white groups like Native Americans and Black Floridians. Such erasure proves problematic for a space that intends to represent Florida's history to primarily tourists who otherwise do not engage with the state's past.
So we see with the idea of Disney Springs, that it promotes sort of this pioneer heritage of the state's past, that the state of Florida doesn't really begin until 1850, when the Sinclairs supposedly arrived. This type of sort of establishing Florida's beginnings with the arrival of white settlers from other southern states isn't unique to Disney. You can go to sort of heritage festivals all across the state and find similar sort of retellings of when the state of Florida began. So what we see happening isn't necessarily so much of an intentional effort to exclude, but an exclusion through erasure. We see that, for instance, Native Americans are nowhere to be seen. And in part, this is very much a consequence of what has gone on in Florida, in the American South, and Eastern North America as a whole. It is not necessarily coincidental, I think, that the Sinclairs in this story begin to arrive in 1850. This is after a pretty merciless war against Florida's indigenous peoples in the Second Seminole War, with the effort to expel, exterminate, and relocate Florida's indigenous peoples in the wake of the 1830 Indian Removal Act. We also see some other exclusionary elements of this past being told as it comes to both Florida's Black population as well. We know through state law in Florida that there are going to be prohibitions on free Black Southerners moving into Florida before the American Civil War. We know that tourist spaces throughout the 20th century were segregated, and we don't necessarily see any sort of acknowledgement of that. And we also see ways in which the architecture of buildings that supposedly date back to the 19th century or the early 20th century don't acknowledge that as well. The way I look at how Disney Springs operates is again, sort of a site of historical memory. It is certainly a fabricated space, and it is a fabricated story, but it is a retelling of the past of Central Florida. And it is engaging with very specific sort of chronological points in which this state has transformed. And so as a historian, it gives me sort of the opportunity to look and see sort of what is being emphasized, what's being maybe silenced, and what are people largely going to take away. A lot of the elements of Disney Springs are going to be overlooked by the average consumer, but I think the average consumer, though, will see sort of this presentation of Florida's past in a consumer environment that becomes very focused. And a lot of people who are probably visiting Disney Springs, that will be sort of their only exposure to Florida history. And that will be what they take with them after they leave from their vacation.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find out about upcoming events like the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum being held in downtown Orlando May 15th through 17th with special presentations and tours of historic sites and museums. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now from the Library of Florida History in Cocoa is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, historically, Florida projects a reputation as a space for healing and good health, but there have been outbreaks of disease that challenge that marketing image.
The outbreak of St. Louis encephalitis in August 1962 in Pinellas County brought together forces of public health, emerging ecological science, and the economics of tourism. In his spring 2007 article, A Plague in Paradise, Eric Jarvis, at the time of writing an associate professor of history at King's University College in London, Ontario, Canada, examined what the National Center for Disease Control labeled as, quote, a major epidemic. Understand the multifaceted implications of 190 cases of encephalitis that killed 38 people. Encephalitis, sometimes called sleeping sickness, is identified with symptoms that include weakness, nausea, high fever, severe headache, mental confusion, and drowsiness, potentially leading to coma and death. Unlike many epidemics, this inflammation of the brain is not contagious, that is, it is not spread from human to human, but spreads from bird to mosquito to human. For all the concern it caused, the 1962 Pinellas encephalitis strain was relatively mild, with an anticipated death rate of 5 to 30%.
And Connie, confronted with the sudden appearance of a deadly disease, city and county officials and public health professionals developed strategies for addressing the problem, right?
The battle against the disease was fought on two levels, mobilization for mosquito control and mobilization to control negative publicity. The use of terms such as mobilization and battle fit with the rhetoric of war that other historians have identified in conjunction with human interaction with insects. Edmund P. Russell III titled his book War and Nature, Fighting Humans and Insects with Chemicals from World War I to Silent Spring. 3 years later, Gordon Patterson similarly focused on the Sunshine State in his book, The Mosquito Wars, A History of Mosquito Control in Florida. During the Pinellas County epidemic, Florida Health News declared the mosquito, quote, man's greatest enemy that could only be controlled through all-out war that demanded night and day battle, end quote. The St. Petersburg Times called upon citizens to, quote, fight with every weapon at our disposal, and, end quote, and recognize that such battle would, quote, require a big war chest to open an immediate sustained offensive, end quote. Fittingly, some frontline soldiers in the fight were civil defense workers. The strategy adopted by the county unfolded in three parts. First, officials called for policing and eradication of potential breeding mosquito sites. The job was viewed as too big for county workers alone, and calls went out for volunteers. To encourage public action, the public health director appropriated John F. Kennedy's inauguration speech, quote, this is not a time to wonder what the state board or county board of health can do for you, but what you, as citizens, can do for yourselves in lending a hand, end quote. Pinellas Countyans did pitch in to clean up their own property, but they resisted calls to conduct similar efforts around absent neighbors' houses. The second strategy focused on the bird carriers of the disease. Pinellas County had one of the highest bird populations in the state, and residents, many of whom were retirees, enjoyed watching and feeding the birds. When county officials outlawed bird feeders, the Audubon Society objected, national news outlets ridiculed the effort, and citizens defied the law as an example of cruelty. In fact, given the season, there was plenty of food available to bird populations, and there were no examples of bird die-off due to the edict. The third strategy centered on the use of chemical insecticides. Fogging trucks became ubiquitous, roaming in neighborhoods, spraying 40 gallons an hour from August the 6th to September the 2nd. A total of more than 70,000 gallons of insecticide filled the air and settled on lawns and water, clothing, and human skin. Homeowners were encouraged to spray breeding areas that might escape the larger spraying efforts, including indoor areas. The insecticide of choice was DDT and Lindane. The environmental irony of the third strategy was lost on everyone. In 1962, Rachel Carson, a friend of St. Petersburg Times editor Nelson Pointer, published Silent Spring. As Eric Jarvis notes, quote, The paper printed stories about fogging with malathion and the use of Paris green pellets, in some cases, side by side with articles about Silent Spring and its theories, end quote. At no point did the Times make a connection between Carson's warnings about fogging and insecticide use and the techniques employed against encephalitis in Pinellas County. Even critics of fogging did not employ the connection. In 1960, 2 years before the encephalitis outbreak, the State Board of Health instituted regulations for the use of insecticides in residential areas, but lost a lawsuit initiated by commercial users against the regulations.
Connie, communication was an essential tool for officials and professionals in conveying the seriousness of the epidemic and the steps for addressing the causes, but they also had an eye on the impact of such news for the local economy.
A second campaign focused on the epidemic's potential impact on winter tourism. In this case, the enemy was negative publicity. Bad press equaled bad tourist season. CBS News and the New York Times provided the most damning coverage. In one newscast, Walter Cronkite included an admission by the Pinellas County Health Director that the epidemic was of serious proportions and that it would be catastrophic as far as the economy of the community was concerned. David Binder of the New York Times covered the story with what the local paper described as painful accuracy, although he could not resist making exaggerated comparisons between Pinellas County and Albert Camus' description of an Algerian city in his book, The Plague. City and county officials, motel owners, and chambers of commerce were infuriated and doubled their efforts to control the language and downplay the seriousness of the situation. The most disturbing attempt to deal with bad publicity came in the form of pressure on Dr. Harry C. Ord, the county's communicable disease officer, to moderate his reports to the press. At the end of August, he resigned his position, but was quickly reinstated. In response, the St. Petersburg Times published an article titled, "Virus is Pressure Proof," in which the editor admonished, quote, "You can't ignore a communicable virus out of existence," noting that the city lost a nationally recognized expert when they needed him the most. The editor chastised, quote, "Utterly unrealistic and short-sighted attitude on the part of some individuals who ought to know better," end quote. In the end, Jarvis concludes, quote, "The economic impact of the encephalitis epidemic on St. Petersburg and its immediate region remained unclear," end quote. Despite reports of canceled conventions and the potential loss of tourist dollars, no motel or hotel closed its doors. The lack of coverage of the aftermath of the epidemic can be explained by the emergence of two stories in late September and October: James Meredith's efforts to desegregate the University of Mississippi and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Jarvis concludes that the symbiotic relationship between Florida's prosperity and its promotion of an environmentally healthy image explain the two-pronged battle against encephalitis and the economic impact of a plague in paradise.
And unfortunately, we are still dealing with serious disease outbreaks today. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Poet Ariel Francisco grew up in Miami and earned a master's degree in fine arts and poetry at Florida International University. In his latest book of poetry, All the Places We Love Have Been Left in Ruins, Francisco reflects on the changes he's seen in Miami in the past couple of decades.
Miami is constantly getting a makeover. Everything is constantly under construction. Different people moving in, moving out. So it's beautiful and horrible the way it's just kind of constantly morphing and I don't know if adapting is the right word, but it's a city constantly in flux, which is part of what makes it great, part of what makes it awful.
In the poem, Even Churchill's is Closing, Ariel Francisco remembers the good times he had in a popular music venue that is now demolished.
So we used to go out there when I was maybe between like 19 and 22. And what a place. I mean, we just get hammered and just watch whatever band happened to be playing. That's not my scene at all, really. But one of my buddies was like, we got to go out there. We used to love this band, the Jacuzzi Boys, who are a local band. I don't know if they're still making music, but it was like a surf rock type band. And it was just a blast. And it was such a weird kind of pub atmosphere. I mean, they had the soccer games on all the time, especially in the middle of the night, because I guess they'd be playing in Europe, right? And just all kinds of strange bands. They used to have some kind of noise conference there. So it was all like this weird noise music that sounded like a giant air conditioner shutting down. But it was just a place with so much character and just so many different kinds of people there. It was a lot of fun. It was disgusting. That wasn't a joke about how, you know, it seemed like how infrequently it was cleaned. But it was always had a good time there. Just a lot of good people, a lot of good music, and just the kind of chaos that is very particular to Miami, I think, was very alive at Churchill's.
Francisco presents his poems in both Spanish and English. In the poem Insomniami, he describes Miami as a city with a history of hurricanes and fraud.
I've always thought that it's really a microcosm of everything that's wrong with the country in general. But I don't want to only speak ill of it, but that's kind of a lot of what perpetuated that poem was, like the actual sleeplessness of my 20s paired with just thinking about all of this. It feels like a sinking ship. It really does. But like nobody seems to care. You know, they're just like, no, it's fine. It's just you want to ride it out as long as you can. And that's a crazy way to run a city, to run a state.
Ariel Francisco discussed his new book of poetry, All the Places We Love Have Been Left in Ruins, at the Miami Book Fair. He first attended the event at age 11 and has appeared there several times as an author.
It's absurd that such a rich literary, not even event, but like circus in a good way, happens in such a place with all these problems, all these political problems, all these climate problems. But then you have like this art-centric, book-centric, gigantic event taking place in the heart of it. While they're banning books, right? It's really, again, it's peak Miami to have both things simultaneously, to have one of the largest, I think it's the largest book fair in the country, if not one of the largest, paired with all these insane politicians who are actively banning books and causing all these problems. For those two things to exist at once is very Miami, I think. But the book fair is just the best, man. It's how do you not spend all your money here? You know, it brings my favorite people together, which is people who spend all their money on books are at the Miami Book Fair, and that's who I am, and that's who I want to be around.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.